My name is Denise Goodman, some of you, and I haven't sat down and talked yet. And I'm here since June 5th, teaching on the subject of Native Americans. And I have been doing something that's a little bit difficult for you who come in for like one session or two sessions. I've been doing some teaching that, because it's a tape ministry, I tried to connect all. I have 15 sessions in all. And so in some cases, some of what I say is for the benefit of people who are following along in a series, a sequence of tape ministry. But I don't mean to exclude, you know, those of you who just came in that process. And so I'm striving to make this self-contained enough so that if this is the only one you make it to, with all the choices that there are, that I will also give you something that's helpful. I really appreciate what Scott's been saying about, if you like what I say, if it's helpful to you in your own journey, keep it. If you don't like it or you want to talk about it with me, maybe in a private setting, if my theology is bad or whatever, I really welcome that side of it too, because we've been talking about blindness. You know, we have our blindnesses, and I know that I do too. The subject today is, the title is Give the Papoose a Chance, and the topic is Native American spirituality, Indian efforts to retain the deep spiritual basis of their lives. One of the things that I talked about yesterday was the problem of stereotyping, in which real three-dimensional living people are portrayed as two-dimensional, sort of flat or unidimensional people. Sometimes Indians are portrayed as savages or drunken or whatever. And that is not helpful, because the whole population of Indian people includes people who are suffering from the obsessive illness of drunkenness, of alcohol. And it includes people who are not only angry and aggressive, but willing to hurt others. But it also includes so many other dimensions, the dimensions of uniqueness among Indian peoples equal to the dimension of uniqueness amongst Lutherans or anybody else. So we were talking about stereotypes. One stereotype that is also not helpful is that Indians are deeply spiritual in everything they do, and you know, you see someone taking a walk and they assume that, you know, your thought is on great deep spiritual things, when in fact you're kind of thinking about the blister on your toe. You know, it's not helpful to unidimensionalize one person or one group of people. And that's one of my cautions in this particular book. I didn't actually order this book for you to buy in the bookstore, because I feel that it has a great fault in the fact that this person, while conveying some really accurate information about Indians, is unable to get through a kind of unidimensional relationship to whites. Whites are really characterized in this book. So I like this book for the information, the accurate information it has about Indians. Excellent, really accurate. I'm troubled by the bias, the anger in this book. Okay. The big question on today's agenda, give the papoose a chance, is whether we talk about spirituality or we experience. To me, that is an enormous question. Enormous question. What I would like to offer to you is I don't know whether these got put away and this is the one that doesn't work or what, but if this is time and this is where each of us are as individuals, somewhere we all come from some place. For some reason, whatever our past, our history, our journey, our perspective, our lives, wherever they were before this moment, where whatever range or places we've personally come from, we find ourselves here in this one space together. I may never truly experience or understand you in what you were before this moment. I may not be able to perceive or understand everything about what you have been in the past. But for this 1 hour that we're here, we have something, a common experience, a common moment. Our lives have come together. And it is my belief that where we go from this minute, if I go, you know, wherever my life takes me and you go wherever your life takes you, something is happening now that gives us something common to talk about. The fact that we've all been at Holden on June 19th, 1985. Now, my experience of this moment is from, you know, this perspective. And yours is from this perspective that you have. And so, in the sense, you see, I didn't bring this together into one sort of all-inclusive point that we're all going to be exactly the same during this hour. You know, we're going to experience our time together. But for me, educationally, this is really important because we have any kind of shared experience gives us a basis where the, let me draw it like this. If my life is a circle like this, and your life is a circle like this, the parts that we are really connected in is this part that we share here. There may be things about my life that I can't share with you or have you experience. And I, you know, there's going to be a lot about your life that I won't know. But whatever we do together, we can begin to understand, have some common ground. So the question for me is, what is the best thing to do? To do spirituality, to get into your spirituality, or to talk about, you know, for me to share a moment of spirituality, or for us to talk about spirituality. And I'm trying to make a connection between this and what Gary was saying about the new paradigm. Gary's been teaching in one of the exciting lectures. There is a new thing about in the land that he says is a part of the feminist critique of our world that says you don't have to talk about experiences. You know, we don't have to talk about love, forgiveness, reconciliation so much as we can begin to do it. Matthew Fox, I asked him from his teaching, which has been about creation-centered spirituality, tell us what you're trying to tell us without any words. And immediately he started, he took hold of the person next to him and, you know, told those to take hold of each other and communicated to us that we should touch each other, we should stand up, we should step out and follow and begin dancing together. I'm wondering if that isn't very exciting education. So in that sense, I'm going to ask you to kind of do a little bit of dancing. Would you come to the inside circle? And if there aren't enough chairs, put some more in there. And so we have one unbroken connection with each other. I'm not really going to ask you to dance around, so you don't have to get scared. It's not scary. And maybe we can kind of come in a little bit. Would you all stand and face the east? And maybe before we begin, what is spirit? Where is your spirit as you're standing there? When two or more are gathered in my name, I will be with you. Where is the spirit of God in this room right now? I will always be with you. I will never leave you. The body of Christ given for you, the blood of Christ given for you, and you took it and you ate it. Where is spirit within you? What is your Lutheran spirituality? As we look to the east, we see not only this moment in time, but we also sense the history of other moments in time in this place. Some of us have been in this circle around this hearth before. And somehow there's some continuation of that here. Our eyes are challenged by that painting. As if this moment in time is a resurrection moment evoked by that painting. As if this space still somehow carries the vibrations of the boots of the miners. And maybe even this very spot of ground vibrates from the footsteps of the Chelan and other tribes who came through. The connection between this space and this place and those are televisions behind those boxes. So that, you know, we're here in Lake Chelan, up in the mountains, and yet the whole world is here. We could be a representation of the whole universe in this circle right here. And we could send our spirits out to the east. To the sun. In the direction of yellow. We could sense a connectedness between us and the rest of life that's going on in this direction. The trees that are growing, the deer that are birthing, the animals, the plants, the earth as it is eroding, the waters that are washing. In this place, with these feet on this ground, we can get a sense of us spinning on this beautiful blue marble, dancing through space in the universe. Our spirit can go forth in this direction. Let us turn to the south.
as we turn to the south, the color of black the reality of darkness, the gentleness of an embracing night, the warmth and shelter of God's wing, the truth about that which is in us that frightens us, that which we have done wrong, those separations that are there, that personal alienation. As we look to the south, the reality of the land, the trees that are cut. In this direction, we have the mine. This just ugly scar on the earth. This bleeding and pouring out of the blood of Mother Earth. This hurting and cutting and birthing that our Mother Earth has been doing to keep us alive, to continue to give us life. Our spirits can go beyond these mountains, across the Pacific, to those peoples who are doing spirituality, the temples, the prayers, those who work to feed others. Let your spirit experience the South, the people in Central and South America, the tears of the women in the plaza, standing there representing those who are missing, the isolation and aloneness of those who are sitting on the Antarctic ice area watching for invading missiles. Your spirit going out to the south comes around to encircle yourself again. And we turn to the west. As we turn to the west, color red, the sacred road, the way of life that teaches us that our steps are sacred, our person is sacred. The color red, our spirits, think of the sun setting and turning blood red, reminding us of our mortality, the reality of our ending, the limited life that we have here. And with that reality, the sure assurance that setting sun will again rise to the east, that what is for us a setting sun is for another a rising sun. Our spirits go out to the west, to the water, the birthing place of life, where the salmon play and grow, where the whales sing, our home, our place of beginning, our place of rest, our place of healing. Our spirits go out to the west. Return to the north. As we turn to the north, we experience the color white, a part of us, our strength, our gift, our purity, our beauty, our light. Can send our spirit in this direction, knowing that our brothers and sisters are there on the earth, that the birds fly in this direction with the coming of life, and we're somehow connected to that. And we turn to the east. We look within, we look down, we look at our feet, we look at this Mother Earth of ours, look at ourselves, seeing not only our own physical bodies as they are now, but as they were when they were infant and toddler and teenager, as they will be for some of us as we live and die. Experience and with your spirit, embrace and accept all that you are. Let your spirit sink down through your feet and touch your Mother Earth that holds you here, keeps you here, keeps you solid on this ground, keeps you standing up, feeds you, healed you. And we are all children of the same Mother Earth. And look up for a minute. Remember the incredible wheel of the heavens, the stars, the planets, the galaxies, the universes that are up there. The light that we stand in, coming from our own personal star. The individual elements and rays that pass through our bodies, changing us every moment. That spark of energy and life that is within us, that beginning spark, that which is more than us, more than humanity, more than any living thing on the planet Earth. That flame of spirit, that touch of Pentecost that comes to us. Our Creator, our Forgiver, Redeemer, Healer, Comforter. Not dependent on whether or not we earned it, but just freely given to us. Join me in pondering the wonder of our moment of existence and seeing ahead that our life is being passed to the next generation, to the seventh generation, to the 77th generation. Can you help me understand Lutheran spirituality? Just for a moment.
Fullness of the soul.
You think about it a lot in our worship, in our singing, in our banner making.
Sometimes I think Lutherans get a sense of closeness to God when they're in community with us in worship. At least that's when I get a great sense of spirituality. personally, for me, that happens when we're singing.
All of our experiences of community, for me, are the valued times of spirituality, whether that be singing and worship or singing at railroad tracks along a,
right turn?
Yes. Both have equal power for fullness of God in that moment of being community.
I'll share with you a wonderful moment of spirituality at the One in the Spirit conference we had. And we were talking about spirituality of the Paiute elder, because Terry Tafoya, one of our teachers, was telling us that if someone, the wrong person, walked directly behind the sacred elders, the elders would fall over into a kind of a trance. And boy, that sounded like different stuff to us. Well, you know, we don't talk about that kind of spirituality in Lutheran churches. And I said that, you know, I said, well, we don't talk about spirituality like that in Lutheran churches. And then they said to me, the next day, would you preach for our closing worship? And I said, sure. The text for that Sunday was the Transfiguration. So I had to immediately stand up and apologize that we don't talk about spirituality. What? How can you get more spiritual than Moses and Elijah walking at the top of the mountain and Christ being transfigured? So we did talk about the same things, but we have different language, different translation, different... There's some connections, I believe, between... you know, the transfiguration experience, and a little bit about what those elders were talking about. I'm not qualified to talk about all those connections. It's one of these kinds of experiences for me, that there are some commonalities that I can really feel like they're there, but there's some other stuff that I'm not sure about at all. Yes?
Well, not being a Lutheran, I don't really know either your theology or how it really is, but somewhat from my historical perspective, what I considered an important contribution is Luther's insistence that each individual believer can approach his maker himself. He doesn't have to go through priests and rituals, that there can be a personal relationship between the believer and his maker.
That's helpful, because that is partly a description of spirituality. And that's a good connection to Indian spirituality. There is, this might be a moment to share a difference between some theologies or spiritualities that are not Indian and some of the native indigenous spiritualities. One of those real, what I'm sensing is a big difference, is in a prayer circle to the six directions, we may have a sense, a strong sense that doing this is not a personal experience. Creating a representation of the universe and praying to the six directions and establishing a communication across the sacred blue road between us and God. Our forming a circle is a standing on the sacred red road that is a sacred way to live life. For Indian spirituality, that moment is not personal. That is a moment for the universe, for the creation, for the people. On the reservation today, people face the east to pray. And it is a sense that they're praying not only for their person,
or even for their whole people, their whole tribe. But one of the things that has made me much of what I am is my realization that a lot of elders are praying for the yellow people, for the Asians, for the blacks, for the Indians, for the Chicanos, for the whites, including the whole universe in their prayers, and believing that the visions that they have when they pray, the sense of spirituality that they are experiencing, are gifts from the Creator for the whole of creation. This is the most exciting thing about Native American spirituality. When the non-Indians first came and experienced Indian people, many of the elders said, don't talk about our truth. Keep it hidden, what we believe. Don't do those rituals when those others are not there. And if they should see it, don't tell them what it really was, what we're doing. They're not ready. And suddenly, what I've been hearing is like about, in the last 75 years, 50 years, tribe after tribe, elder after elder, has said, now, this can be shared. This can be given. This is a gift for the rest of the world. I'm really amazed at the new attitude amongst the elders for teaching. And even as I say that, I have to tell this one very important thing for you. Terrible for me to talk about spirituality. Because in the issue of spirituality, I'm such a baby. But I can't tell you anything, really. Two and a half years ago, when I went back to the Black Hills for a spiritual gathering, I learned a lot of things. And one of the things that I learned is that I had just been born as a spiritual seeker. I was just a baby. And now I'm only 2 years old. So it's really hard. I don't have that authority to teach spiritual fruit. If you could hear about spirituality from the elders. You know, from the reality is, you know, I'm that little one about spirituality. And that's not only just in terms of what I know and don't know, but it's also in terms of what I have authority to say and not to say. You know what I'm saying? If the little kid says, you know, do this, you know that kid doesn't have the authority to tell you to do this. And it's a little bit like that for me in terms of teaching about spirituality or doing spirituality. I'm very reluctant to talk about the spiritual ways of any individual tribal group because I'm not a teacher, I'm not an elder. And that's a real, I find that to be a real cultural difference. That I kind of struggle with sometimes. I want to lift that up, and I also want to lift up what I think has happened in the history between Indians and non-Indians in understanding Indian spirituality. The title that I gave for this meeting was Give the Peppers a Chance, and I want to share with you how that came about. This is a paragraph the man who's speaking is a man who is responsible for enforcing Indian policy in the United States, and I've forgotten just exactly what year it is, but it's when Okay, 1889, President Benjamin Harrison appointed Thomas Jefferson Morgan, Commissioner of Indian Affairs in the Department of Interior. And in preliminary, his idea was that Indians must cease being Indians. And the most important thing that they must cease is their spirituality. They must give it up. And this is part of our history, this attitude on the part of the government. And here is an expression of that. Morgan said in one speech, pretending to speak for Indian babies. In other words, he said, this is what the Indian babies are saying to me, and I'm telling you this. Told one of his audiences, quote, "These helpless little ones cry out to us. If you leave us here to grow up in our present surroundings, what can we hope for? Our lives will be at the mercy of the medicine man. Our religion will be a vile mixture of superstition, legends, and meaningless ceremonies. Contrasting the doleful lot of young Indians on reservations with what he believed the blessings would be that would come to them when they got a white man's education. He asked, shall they be disappointed? Shall their hopes be blasted? Justice, philanthropy, patriotism, Christianity answered these little babies, no. And let all the people speaking through their representatives in Congress answer, no. Give the Papoose a chance. And it goes on to say that this is the overwhelming non-Indian sentiment about Native Americans and their cultures in the years that followed the end of the Indian War. It was a voice that lifted up the policy of forced assimilation. And that policy has wreaked havoc on the spirituality of Indian people and on their society to this day. This is not unusual, what he said. There had been a long legacy of people saying the same thing from the very beginning. And there are many, many people today who believe that's true. One time I invited an Indian person to speak to a congregation, and the pastor asked me if he was Christian. I think some people wonder whether I'm Christian or not when I pray to the Sixth Direction. What do we do with that? That history, that reality. Yesterday I was drawing unhelpful stereotypes on the board. One of those unhelpful stereotypes, I think, is the concept of sage, which allows us to set up a polarity between those who are sage and those who are not sage. Or the concept of chosen. Those who are chosen and not set, not chosen. This is, I think, my 10th lecture, and all the way through I've had such a difficult time telling the true story about what happened to Indians in different areas. And the story that's recorded in this particular chapter about Indians and their spirituality is really a painful and unhappy story. And it's a story in which religious convictions were oftentimes the energy behind the most destructive practices of genocide. Genocide means the killing off of a race of people or killing off of their culture. But it's so important to be sensitive to the fact that religion has been so basic to the destruction of Indian people. Because it's also the core of understanding the survival of Indian people. It is the heart of understanding Indian people. I used to be a public school teacher. And I couldn't stay in public school teaching because how could I, in fact I was teaching Indian people and Eskimos, Yupik Eskimos. And I couldn't stay in it because how could I teach Indian and have a rule about the separation of church and state and not talk about religion? It was very self-destructive and very unwholesome for me to separate between what we were talking about and our spirituality, our sacredness, our religion. It's not a question of what do you teach? In other words, what is your creation story? What is your ritual? What is the meaning? What symbols do you use? And what do those symbols mean? Okay, let me say that a little more specifically. It isn't that I stand here and talk about the sacredness of this particular stone or these particular trees or those birds or your own person. It's not that the sacredness is in that thing, but that God or the Creator is here and here and in you too. To me, the important thing to study about Indian spirituality is not whether we talk about whether the form of expression of spirituality is in the putting on of a mask or the wearing of eagle feathers or the dressing of clothes. Because those are all very important parts of it. But the thing is that I can have all of Indian spirituality without that. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? Those are like the words. I was kind of paying attention to Gary. Those are like the words in the Lutheran Church. And yet, you know, if we say in the Apostles' Creed, I believe in God the Father Almighty, what is what we believe in? Is it the words on the piece of paper? Or is it the Creator? For me to sit here and try to do some translating between Indian spirituality and Lutheran spirituality and make some connections, which are, for me, the connections are so much more important than the differences. What do Lutherans believe when they describe the Creator in the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed? Gary was saying, you can't contain the Creator in those words on a piece of paper. Right? And I think that was a real misunderstanding between people who came and saw a ritual that Indian people were doing and their understanding of it. I've been talking about this sort of off and on. Terry Sequoia taught me a little bit about that when he said to us who were Lutherans there that we were the singing people. From the outside, looking at Lutheran religion, you might say that you're the singing people. Or he said, another way that you could call us is the banner people.
You see how, in terms of translating, by calling you the singing people or the banner people, you're the banner religion. In a sense, I have captured something of what Lutheran is. Okay? But just think how much of it I missed in just saying Lutheranism is the making of banners. Okay? Lutheranism is the singing of songs. Well, that's kind of what happened with Indian people. Our religion is much more than the wearing of feathers or the dancing of a dance or the praying of a prayer or speaking in a language or turning in six directions. Yeah.
You could correlate the wearing of feathers to the pastors wearing the vestment, you know, their intercessory prayers where they turn to the altar. You could cover the same prayers that you turn to directions, and you're just using your directions. That, I mean, I've heard people who use things of a certain, say, government, people, children, whatever. And it's just another form of something to help you in symbolism of reminding you what to pray for and how to pray for. So there's a lot of things that you can just learn from each other and how you're, except that I feel that because the Indians probably live closer to nature, I mean, they, you know, they depended so much on God's provision of the animals, more like the farmers today, you know, the wind, the rain, and because they were more aware of that, that by turning to the directions and putting that together was more meaningful to them. Whereas Europeans who came here were in houses before they came. They came here and they wanted houses again, and they're closed off in a way from the winds and the rain.
I think that there has been this failure to translate, and partly because of the language barriers. There has been this inability to accurately translate the meaning of a ritual. One of the rituals that I'm particularly interested in touch with is the first salmon ceremony, where the first salmon that comes up the river is that the first one that's caught is ceremonially cut up, and everyone participates in it, and it's a kind of a Eucharist, a thanksgiving for what has been provided, and a prayer almost to receive for the rest of the season an abundance of fish. And the careful gathering together of the salmon bones and the blessings and the songs and the thanksgiving and the joy, all done very appropriately, you know, certain patterns and rituals that it's very important for us to do it the right way in order to ensure that in fact it will be a prosperous year, a prosperous season, so that every single bone is returned to the waters. Every single tiny bone of the first salmon is returned back to the waters, a gift back, so that the rest of the salmon people will come. It isn't so much the form of what you do, but why you do it, that's the most important thing. The purpose of this particular book, one of the purposes, I think, is to lift up areas that go on today that are particularly difficult in terms of Indian spirituality and Indian-white relations. And I just wanted to lift up a couple of those. One is the degradation of religious symbols. For example, the Cleveland Indians with the sacred eagle feather in his head, being trivialized and degraded. You know, why in 1985 are we still doing this? It's a, you know, there's so many things. I talk to the children in the fire circle, and dancing is a very sacred thing. Dancing is allowing the spirit to be amongst the people and even within ourselves. It's an expression of not only the spirit within, but the spirit of the people. And yet, even today, the little children have already learned to trivialize and degrade Indian dancing. That the minute I said I was Indian, they immediately started and they're still learning those things. It's a little bit like having Lutheran worship, the high mass where the bishop is, preaching, and then sort of selling tickets and having a gallery around the outside to watch it. That a lot of that goes on in terms of Indian spirituality, where people come to see what the Indians are doing. It's a real strange phenomenon. Yes.
You think of that perhaps as though a lot of just curiosity. I mean, not a lot of people would know about it, and so because Christianity is so, kind of, it's out there. People know about it more than they know about the Indian spirituality, so they're curious about it. So that kind of image, basically, because they don't know about it, so they want to learn it, just becomes sort of curiosity.
And there's a lot of reasons, ignorance is one of them. Really true. There are some other things that go on that are not necessarily because of ignorance, though. One of the stories that are told in this book is the appropriation of sacred land because of its mineral or water wealth, or because of its timber or whatever. In the United States, one of the things that goes on, it's a little bit like the federal government saying, we need a building for community meetings, so we're going to claim ownership of all Lutheran buildings. People, even today, say, there's only 100 people on this reservation of 7,000 acres, and it isn't fair for these 100 people to have these 7,000 acres when we need the 7,000 acres, and we need this mineral, and we need this whatever. And there are still today being laws introduced that suggest that we should abrogate. I think it's kind of tough. I would like to share with you a lot of things about spirituality, but I'm having some trouble translating between one and the other. I think I'll stop there, and if you have some questions, I'll deal with them.
I was just thinking how I would like someone to come in and say, this garden space that your husband has, we want that, we need that for the city. I would rebel, I wouldn't like it. He worked for years for that, through his own toil, through prayers, loss of sleep, to pay for everything.
How many farmers are experiencing this?
I know. 7th century. turned around or taking over of land through legal rights and legal representation of Indians.
Like the claims that are filed to restore lands to Indians that were taken illegally without compensation? Yes.
Now, I think that would make them have second thoughts of trying to take over other lands.
That's an interesting thing. There's a whole chapter about that, where a claim was filed. The only thing that got out in the media is that this incredible claim was filed. What never got out was that the years and years of effort to resolve the conflict without filing a claim for 12.5 million acres of land. You know, the beginning with the signing of a treaty that said this shall be Indian land, all the way through to court cases and, you know, so on and so on and so on. So many people only heard about the filing of a claim for 12.5 million acres without ever knowing all that led up to that. So that's part of it. And that book is a good place to hear the whole story. It's real tough for me to sit here and tell you those stories. And you might be asking yourself, what is it about my culture and my society that I don't know those stories?